Chapter 45. Ron stayed at Rhonda Beamer's house the night before the moratorium. Rhonda's father owned a furniture store, and he wanted to be known as a man whose family and home were a showcase. Rhonda showed Ron the marble tables in the vestibule, the French provincial chairs and couches in the parlor, the form-fitting plexiglass table in the kitchen, and the little girl canopy bed, which was truly her favorite thing in the world, with a sense of pride and reverence. "Who sleeps in here?" Ron asked, expecting to be told about a little sister. "This is my room," beamed Rhonda. Ron looked at the bed again and smiled. "I guess that you don't mind sleeping all sort of scrunched up." "I never had a problem," said Rhonda defensively. "I'm all over the bed," said Ron. "I'll bet you are." Rhonda smiled when she saw he was staring at the cleavage of her low-cut sweater. "The gang will probably all sleep in rec room." "What gang?" Ron was quickly deciding that he didn't care if he got nowhere with this girl. "The college gang, you know," said Rhonda. "Anybody who wants to come over. Would you like something to drink?" "Some coffee." "Would you like to trip a little?" She smiled her best showcase smile. "Are you going to trip?" "I think I'll just take some speed. Probably won't change anything. I've been speeding all day." "I just smoke pot," said Ron, feeling like he was saying, "I'm a meat and potatoes man." "That's not too bad, really." She licked her lips, and Ron saw that they glistened. Rhonda's smile had been the best gift her daddy had given her. The cost of her braces and orthodontist work could have furnished an entire house. Mr. Beamer liked to stand back and admire the work. "Rhonda," he would say, "you were a very pretty girl in your own right, but that with that smile, you could be one of the stars." Rhonda had forgotten by that time the way she cried when she first heard him use the same line on one of his customers. "Mrs. Liverman, your house is very pretty in its own right, but with this carpet, you could be one of the stars." She had sulked for days and never told her father why. After a while, she wasn't even sure why it had upset her so. She led Ron into the rec room. It sported an artificial brick fireplace and an artificial fire. The chairs were covered with heavy plastic, and the floors were block tile. It was hard to wash, but Mrs. Beamer didn't mind, as long as they could afford a colored maid. Mrs. Beamer was fond of calling her the cleaning lady, who came on Thursdays, the maid. Rhonda sat on Ron's lap. He liked the way her ass felt on his legs. He could put up with a lot for an ass like that. "I'm really happy that we're finally getting a chance to know each other." "Yeah, me too," said Ron. He squeezed her thigh, and she gave him a short, sexy giggle. Maybe if he could fuck her, he would like her. "It would really be great to drop acid in Washington again tomorrow, wouldn't it?" "I guess so," said Ron. "But I really want to see what's happening. What I really think can happen seems more immense than acid." "You think the war is more immense than acid?" "Yes," said Ron. "Maybe we shouldn't trip together, huh?" She started to wonder where the rest of the gang was, especially Chris. They arrived in Washington about 7:30 the next morning. Rhonda and Ron made the trip with four other commuter people. There was no sign of Chris in either car. Ron slept through most of the ride, with his hand holding Rhonda's softly sweatered breast. The talking in the car seemed inane, and Ron kept on wondering what had happened to Chris, but he was really more excited by the thought that he was finally going to do something. This would be a damn sight better than sitting around and talking. The morning was bright and extremely cold. Ron had been awake since they left the interstate at the exit marked for Washington. Everything seemed like a normal place, And then, all of a sudden, there it was, all around him. As he saw the buildings and read the names, he was sure he had entered one of his high school history books. The major rally was scheduled for the Washington Monument. The marchers were going to converge from three separate locations. Ron's group assembled at the Lincoln Memorial. The other two groups were assembling at the Capitol Building and the White House. The plan was to march to the Washington Monument simultaneously. When they reached full strength, they would hear speeches and songs. They parked in a 10th Avenue parking lot that was at least 15 blocks from their assembly point. Rhonda grabbed Ron's arm as they got out of the car. "Let's separate from this group as soon as possible," he whispered. "I'm with you," she said with a conspiratorial smile and a sense of glee. Maybe Ron would be fun to be with after all. Ron walked over to Rex Michaels and asked what time they should get back together. "I want to get out of here by 5 p.m., said Rex. "Where are you people off to?" "We're just going to try to take everything in," said Rhonda. "Yeah, just don't get lost," said Rex. Ron said, "I've got the address in my head." Rex shrugged and tugged his shoulder-length hair back under his cowboy hat and walked out with his chick and their friends. Rhonda and Ron laughed their way down 10th Avenue and headed for the Federal Triangle. He liked the way they walked together. They squeezed each other's asses under their coats. "My father brought me here when I was a little girl. He said that he wanted me to see how beautiful our way of life is." They stopped for coffee. "Peace," said the vendor when Ron paid him. "Yeah, peace," said Ron, flashing the guy a quick sign as they walked away. "How does your father feel about the war?" "He said that he's happy he doesn't have a son." Ron's first thought was that Mr. Beamer was somehow a coward for not having a son. He looked at Rhonda and for some insane reason thought that if she wasn't Jewish, she might have been a boy. He wondered if he should tell her that his grandfather had been Jewish. Maybe it would help him get into her pants. "I've never been here before," he said casually. She gave him a searching look. "You should come back here sometime. It's really a beautiful city." "This is just the place the war comes from. When things have changed, maybe then it'll be a good place to visit. That is, if they don't kick us all out of their fucking country." As they neared the Federal Triangle, they saw large numbers of people in the streets. Mostly everybody was wearing blue jeans, field jackets, pea coats. A lot of these people were carrying sleeping bags, said Ron. "There are places to stay all over town," said Rhonda, nodding her head. "That's what I think Chris and the rest of the gang decided to do. A lot of people came in last night for the candlelight vigil." Ron didn't know about any of that stuff. He admired Rhonda's knowledge of what was happening. Who the fuck was he to think that she was an out-of-it chick? She had been around the council longer than he had. It wasn't exactly her fault that all she talked about was her father. Ron stared at her thoughtfully, wondering if she had ever wanted to fuck her father. When they got to Constitution Avenue, it was like they had entered a magical kingdom. All the buildings were immense and seemed tremendous in their magnitude. They were breathing the ideals they stood for out into the morning air. Ron knew he had entered the generator that fueled the pulse of the world, the unreal place where news really happened. It was too large for the real world. It was the front line, and he was one of the reinforcements who had been brought in to bolster the action. "It's too large for me," Ron thought to himself. The street was packed with smiling people saying peace as they passed each other. Ron and Rhonda walked down to the IRS building. Then they turned and retraced their steps, passing the National Archives and crossing in front of the National Art Gallery. "Why does something so beautiful have to be so fucked up?" said Ron. Rhonda didn't answer. At the end of Constitution Avenue, the groups of people became small crowds. Everywhere he looked, Ron saw banners. They carried all the slogans that Ron had heard but before, but somehow they looked more impressive and seemed to have a deeper meaning in this setting. Ron thought there must be more people here than were on most battlefields, and that must count for something. The two of them walked arm in arm through the crowd. "This is incredible," said Ron. "I guess we won't run into any of the other people from our college," said Rhonda. A car with mounted loudspeakers drove by, advising people to leave the area directly after the main demonstration at the monument. Rhonda and Ron found themselves standing with a contingent from NYU. The group was chanting slogans, and the two joined in with them. After about 20 minutes of chanting, Ron saw a group of demonstrators carrying red banners and making an entrance, running, shouting, "Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh, NLF is gonna win." Ron watched the group with a hard stare. They were running hard and seemed determined to push their way to the front of the march. Scattered boos rose up from various sections around the monument. The red flag demonstrators changed their tune to a two-part chant. One half of the group chanted, "America." The other half answered, "Sucks." Ron tightened his fist. This didn't seem right. These people were looking for trouble. Tension rose as the red flag group splintered into various sections of the crowd, continuing their taunts. "America!" screamed the group that had gone to the left side. "Sucks!" came the answer from the right. Rhonda took hold of Ron's hand. "Why don't you people shut the fuck up?" yelled somebody from the NYU contingent. "Fuck you, assholes," came the reply. Ron looked at Rhonda and said, "This isn't any good." "You people are really assholes," screamed Rhonda. Ron stared at them with the hardest look his face could muster. "They make us all look like jerk-offs," he said to the people around him. "And it will be them that the TV cameras use for news." Ron was thinking about Chicago. What would happen if there was a fight here? He remembered watching pictures from the convention on the news. The cops were just cracking other people's faces. But maybe that was only part of the media decided to show about that, too. Again, Ron heard the chant, "Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh, NLF is gonna win." In the middle of the NYU group was a small, skinny, dark-haired guy who was ignoring the chants and telling jokes. "So the Western Union comes to the door and says that he has a telegram. The lady who answers the door asks him to sing it for her. The Western Union guy looks uncomfortable and says that he doesn't think it's the kind of message you should sing. The housewife says, 'Oh, please, I've just wanted just one singing telegram. I'll give you a really good tip if you sing it.' The Western Union guy says, 'Okay,' and sings, 'Da da 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 da, your son is dead.'" Ron laughed, but he thought it was grisly and disgusting, and he didn't know why he was laughing. Another student in the group had a portable radio and was listening to news reports about the march. "Hey," he shouted, "there are over 1 million people here." The crowd buzzed as the word was passed along. Over 1 million people, and Ron was among them. It was too unreal. 1 million people were willing to show up and stand in the cold and forget about their differences. The crowd began to move. The chanting grew more rhythmic and was timed to their steps. They were walking up a small hill that led to the base of the monument. Ron's breath was taken away by the sight from the top of the hill. It was a huge flood of people making themselves comfortable. There was music playing, and the chanting subsided with the sound of it. Ron smelled pot. He looked over and saw Rhonda taking a hit off a huge joint that it was making its way down their row. She gave it to Ron and giggled. He took two tokes and passed it on. The person to his immediate left was a tall girl with reddish brown hair and a magnificent multicolored Indian coat with an intricate design. Ron glanced back over to his right at Rhonda's wool coat. The word Bambergers flashed in his mind, and he wished he could be out with the Indian coat. "I'm not even cold anymore," said Rhonda. Ron realized that he'd forgotten about the cold, too. "It's all the people," he said. "This is absolutely far out," said Rhonda. "It sure is," said Ron. Richie Havens opened the program with the rendition of "Where Have All the Flowers Gone?" Ron floated on the acoustic strumming and the humming voice. The second of two huge joints passed his way, and he took two more hits, gave it to Rhonda. "I can't believe this," she said, smiling. She put her head on Ron's shoulder. "I'm enjoying being here with you," she said softly. "Me too," said Ron, as he stared intently at the sage. By that time, Arlo Guthrie was introduced. Ron had lost more inhibitions and cheered along with everyone else. They were all there to show they enjoyed a different brand of life. They were there to show that they had a different definition of what was right and good. They could do it effortlessly and with laughter. "I'm going to sing one of the songs my father is famous for," said Arlo. "Only I'm not going to leave out the parts they won't let you hear in school and on TV. I'm going to sing all the verses." The crowd cheered. Arlo began singing, "This land is your land," and Ron listened for what he hadn't heard before. The girl in the Indian coat lit a joint, handed it to Ron. She smiled at him with deep, dark eyes. He took the joint and meekly said, "Thank you." He took a hit and tried to give it back to her. "Give everybody else a chance first," she said, smiling. He tried to give the joint to Rhonda, who turned her head abruptly back to the stage just a little too late. "Do you want some of this?" Rhonda gave him a distracted look and said, "Not right now." Ron passed the joint to the guy in back of him. Some of the crowd began to sing along with Arlo. Then they listened to David Dillinger talk about the need for peace in the world. They listened to Abby Hoffman joke about the situation with the Chicago 7. Hoffman said that he knew of certain demonstrations scheduled for later in the day that were earmarked dangerous and unauthorized. "What you have learned and what they have learned is that real danger exists and grows when people are silent. Real danger flourishes when people stop caring. And because you are not silent and do care, you have scared the shit out of them all." Ron was inspired. He felt admiration for Hoffman, who was speaking in spite of a court order that had tried to silence him. He had felt that way about Bobby Kennedy. There were more joints and more musics. A Viet vet said that the army was being kept over there by false promises that the war was nearly over. He said that the soldiers were tired of hearing it and that he had a message from them to give to the president and the rest of the country. "Mr. President," he said, "you may not be here to listen, but the country sure seems to be here." He paused while the crowd cheered itself. "The message is, Mr. President, if you don't bring us home soon, we're going to come home all by ourselves." Ron was stunned by the implications. Suppose the army did just that. They couldn't shoot all of them. Suppose the army decided all by itself to come home. What the fuck could anybody do? The demonstration ended with an announcement from the Moratorium Mobilization Committee recommending that everyone leave the city in an orderly fashion and as soon as possible. Don't give them anything negative to say about us, because you can be sure that if you do, that's all they will talk about tomorrow. What we've accomplished today doesn't deserve to get put down by cheap shots from the press. Ron and Rhonda walked back down Constitution Avenue, pumped up by the energy from the demonstration. There was a guerrilla theater scene being played out on the steps of the National History Museum. People, mostly children, were kneeling down, while a man dressed like a priest was pouring red liquid over them, saying, "These people's blood will keep you free." Ron noticed that the priest was also wearing a black cape, and when he raised his head and smiled, he was the perfect caricature of Dracula. Ron stared fixedly at the image as they walked by. "This is very strange," said Rhonda. "I feel funny when people use religion to attack each other." "Anything that has grown weak and useless deserves to be attacked," said Ron, "particularly if it causes death and destruction." "That's a really frightening idea, Ron, and it's not the peace movement at all." "The beauty of the thing is that it doesn't matter. Why stop the lore as long as it ends itself, right?" The first National Guardsmen that Ron and Rhonda saw were assembled outside the National Art Gallery. They had set up a blockade across from the National Archives building. A group of about 12 people came up the street quickly saying, "Stay away from the Justice Department." Rhonda hadn't understood them, and Ron wasn't sure what department they were talking about. Ron looked over at the National History Building and pointed. "I wonder what that is over there," he said. "Why are those soldiers in the street?" said Rhonda. "I don't know," said Ron. "They're probably blocking off some place they don't want people to go." 10th Avenue is back the other way," said Rhonda. "Let's turn around and walk back toward the car. I'm really pretty tired, and we could just hang out by the car for a while." "That sounds fun." The crowd along Constitutional Avenue had thinned considerably. Ron saw the IRS building and turned right. They were immediately faced with a huge blockade of army jeeps and policemen in full riot gear. The two stopped and looked at each other. Everything had an eerie, quiet intensity.